This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Bodies in the mud, just another monster from the sea.
From the sea.
Told you this was coming. Told you this was coming. A super hurricane, red flag, way up 10 years ago.
After a 1-2 punch of Hurricanes Helene and Milton, four experts on disaster storms during human-made global warming. Popular storm chaser and meteorologist Jeff Masters leads off. You hear from senior research scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, Dr. Michael Wehner, highly cited storm scientist Kerry Emanuel from MIT on the risks of superstorms, environmental planner Patrick Marchman, will there be an exodus from the coasts, climate migration. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to a packed Radio EcoShock special. Let's go.
You said it was a hoax, a deep state scam, caused by radar from Alaska and Jewish space lasers. Nature comes to call from the overheated sea to put your disinformation on trial. Global warming, you can't say that in Florida, the great state of denial.
Some of the most exciting and yet reliable weather reports come from Jeff Masters and Bob Henson. Dr. Jeff Masters worked for the NOAA Hurricane Hunters as a flight meteorologist. He co-founded the Weather Underground. These days we find Jeff posting at Yale Climate Connections with his Eye on the Storm series. His Hurricane Milton update with Bob Henson warned about a catalog of dangers including torrential rains, inland floods, destructive winds, tornadoes, and a potentially catastrophic storm surge. Hurricane Milton was not just one threat, but many. Returning to Radio EcoShock, Jeff Masters, welcome back after another big one.
Hello, Alex.
It was intense television watching hurricane hunters tossed around inside their storm surveillance plane. Jeff, you had some dicey moments yourself flying with NOAA. What are they looking for, and did they find surprising numbers from Milton?
They're looking to find as much information as they possibly can using all their tools. They've got instruments mounted on the actual fuselage of the aircraft that measure pressure, temperature, winds, and humidity. They also have a Doppler radar on board, which gives you a three-dimensional view of the precipitation inside the hurricane. And they also can launch what are called drop sondes, which are little parachute sensors that fall through the storm and radio back information. And for one of the first times ever, they were actually releasing little miniature drones inside Hurricane Milton. These drones flew around for 15 or so minutes and radioed back information. They're still experimental. The data isn't being ingested into the computer forecast models, but the rest of the data from the Hurricane Hunter aircraft is, and that data is critical for making accurate forecasts.
Storm experts talk about pressure in millibars and talk louder when it drops real low, real fast. The rest of us don't know what that means. What were the pressure numbers for Milton, and what do they mean?
So atmospheric pressure is typically around 1,013 millibars. And what that is, it's a measure of the weight of the air on top of you. So if you've got more air on top of you, then it weighs more and your pressure is higher. Conversely, if you don't have much air on top of you, that's low pressure and the air weighs less. So wind will blow in response to changes in pressure. So where you got a big clump of air, a mound of high pressure, right next to an area of low pressure with not as much air, the wind will blow to try and equalize the pressure since nature abhors a vacuum. So the winds of a hurricane are directly proportional to how strong that low pressure center is in the middle of it. And so that's a very important measure of how strong a hurricane is how low that central pressure goes. And Milton's central pressure went down to 897 millibars. So that's more than 10% lower than normal atmospheric pressure. And that 10% drop really drove some extreme winds. In fact, Milton was the fifth strongest Atlantic hurricane ever measured by pressure and sixth strongest by winds. 180 mile per hour winds at its peak.
Experts say don't rely on storm levels like Cat 4 or Cat 5. Several on TV said that the storm surge is already determined out at sea. even if the hurricane weakens to Cat 3 when it hits land. How does that work?
So the storm surge, that's the water that's built up by the winds swirling around the center of the hurricane. So as the winds blow over the ocean, it puts the ocean in motion, and it spins around the center just like the winds spin around the center. So when those ocean waters get to the actual core of the hurricane, they've got nowhere to go except up or down. So in the case when the hurricane's out in the deep ocean, a lot of those waters will tend to go down and flow out towards the bottom of the ocean. But when the hurricane approaches land, now it's in shallow water, particularly off the coast of Florida. You've got a continental shelf where the waters aren't very deep at all, just tens of meters. So that water that's forced to the center of the hurricane now cannot go down very far. And so what you get is a big bulge in the ocean surface. And that giant mound of water gets pulled with the hurricane as it makes landfall, and that creates the storm surge. It's a big bulge of water that moves ashore with the hurricane.
And then somehow it sucked out the water out of Tampa Bay for a short period of time.
Yeah, as the hurricane was approaching Tampa Bay, the counterclockwise circulation around the low was blowing offshore. And when you got wind blowing offshore, it blows the water away from shore. In fact, the water levels in Tampa Bay dropped by about 5 feet as Milton was approaching landfall.
This storm surge, it's terrifying to me, and some who witness it do not survive. Is sea level rise already adding to storm surge, or is that something to come?
Sea level along the west coast of Florida has risen by about a foot over the last 100 years, mostly due to human-caused climate change, making the oceans rise. So that extra foot adds significantly to the damage of a storm surge. We saw during Hurricane Sandy in 2012, when it hit New York City, it did about $60 billion in damage because of its storm surge. Now, we decided that about $8 billion of that $60 billion was extra that would not have occurred without human-caused sea level rise, even though it was only estimated to be on the order of 4 inches, at least what we can say confidently. So that extra 4 inches meant a lot. And that's because the infrastructure of our cities is usually built for the old climate, the climate of the 20th century, where sea levels weren't as high. And if you're going to push an extra foot of storm surge inland, that's going to overwhelm a lot of infrastructure, which was designed for a climate that no longer exists.
And weather reports from South Florida showed 4 days of heavy rain just before Milton landed. It was a different system. And I was worried the already saturated ground would add to flash flooding with the deluge. I haven't seen all the figures yet. I don't know whether that happened, but it's certainly a consideration.
Yeah, a lot of times as a hurricane's approaching, you get what's called a predecessor rain event. That's where you happen to have a front, normal, you know, cold front or warm front that lies over the continental U.S. that acts as a way to concentrate the moisture when it gets there. So we saw this with Hurricane Helene, too. As Hurricane Helene was approaching the southeast U.S., there was a front draped over the southeast part of the country, and we got about 8 to 12 inches of rain over Atlanta, North Carolina, and so on. And when the actual hurricane came, it added to that total. So, yeah, the predecessor rain events moisten the soil, make it more prone for flash flooding to occur when the actual hurricane arrives. And, of course, you're more likely to get power outages because the trees are going to uproot more easily with a wet soil there.
I'd really like to dig in with you, because I know you know these things, how these hurricanes actually work. I mean, I've heard that they cool the oceans. There's some sort of heat exchange going on there. I don't know what happens to that heat energy. Could you tell us how it works?
Hurricanes are heat engines. And what they do is they take heat coming off the ocean in the form of what we call sensible heat. I mean, it's the actual heat radiating from the ocean. And then latent heat, which is the heat energy stored in water vapor that evaporates from the ocean. So when that water vapor evaporates, it has extra energy built into it because of the extra energy it took to convert the water from liquid phase to gas phase. And then when that moisture condenses in the form of rain, it releases that heat energy. So all that heat energy goes to power the hurricane, to intensify its updrafts, and increase its winds. So the more heat energy available in the ocean for a hurricane, the stronger it can potentially get. But at the same time all this is going on, the hurricane's winds are actually acting to help decrease the strength of the hurricane because they're blowing the surface of the ocean, uncovering water from deeper down, which tends to be cooler. So it's kind of a self-cooling mechanism. And if a hurricane's moving very slowly, it'll choke on its own exhaust, so to speak, because the cold water upwelling underneath it will choke off the energy source that has been feeding the storm.
That's interesting, because I was going to ask you, we know hurricanes have no power to move on their own. They get blown around on their course by other wind systems, and Milton was a relatively fast-moving storm, as was Hurricane Helene. Jeff Masters, what are the advantages and disadvantages to a fast-moving hurricane versus storms that stall, like Hurricane Harvey?
A fast-moving hurricane is less prone to dump heavy rains because it's moving so quickly that the rains won't pile up to a large amount over any particular land area. Fast-moving hurricanes are disadvantageous because they tend to bring stronger winds farther inland. So we saw with the case of Hurricane Helene, it was moving about 25 miles an hour at landfall, which is fast for a hurricane, and it maintained hurricane strength 200 miles inland, well into Georgia, bringing substantial damage into that state. Now, a slow-moving hurricane will tend to dump heavier rains because it sits in one place for longer, but the winds don't go as far inland and so cause less destruction farther inland. But on the flip side of that, if it is a slow-moving hurricane, then the places where the winds do blow, they're going to get a lot more damage because if you subject a structure to multiple hours of strong winds, it's more likely to fail compared to if you subject it to those strong winds just for like an hour or two. And with the case of Hurricane Harvey, yeah, that thing just stalled inland, just close enough to the ocean where it kept on pulling in moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, but it wasn't enough far inland to make the storm actually dissipate. So it just kind of sat there and fed and fed and fed off the ocean, dumping heavy and heavier rains all across Texas, generating up to 50 inches of rain, a U.S. record for any hurricane.
Wow. Well, scientists debate whether warming will generate more frequent hurricanes or just larger ones. Michael Mann of Penn State says either way, hurricane activity is increasing. A few big storms might serve the same energy services as many smaller ones or something like that. Do hurricanes serve a dynamic role? Do these storms have a role in nature?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sun heats the planet unequally. I mean, the equator gets a lot more solar energy than the poles. So if there were no mechanism to carry heat from the equator to the poles would get colder and colder and the equator get warmer and warmer. That doesn't happen because ocean currents and atmospheric winds act to redistribute heat. So hurricanes are a big part of that. They form over the tropics, and they take a lot of heat energy with them up to the mid-latitudes and then the higher latitudes. So that's an essential service that the planet needs to keep its balance so that we don't get into this state where, you know, the Arctic gets too cold and the equator gets too hot. And if we didn't have hurricanes, well, I'm not sure what we'd have. Maybe even a worse situation somehow. Certainly things would be drastically altered. Maybe ocean currents could make up for part of that deficit. Other types of storms might have to do it.
Veteran Florida meteorologist John Morales from NBC Miami was astonished to see a supercell appearing on the border of Milton, the kind of vertical wind seen in Kansas, but not in Florida, he said. Deadly tornadoes spread from massive Milton just like sparks from Crown wildfires. Lightning filled the sky hundreds of miles away from the hurricane core. Are we seeing something new?
We've never seen a tornado outbreak in Florida anywhere close to what Milton did. We have seen some tornado outbreaks that have made a lot more tornadoes than Milton, though. Milton generated about 38 tornadoes, we think, so far. There are three hurricanes in the past that have made over 100. Most of these tornadoes tend to be weak, EF0, EF1s, winds less than 100 miles per hour a lot of times. But what was unusual about Milton is we had multiple tornadoes that were, like Mr. Morales said, supercell tornadoes like you see in the Midwest. And I expect at least one or two of these are going to be EF2, EF3s. And EF3 is the strongest sort of intensity of tornadoes ever been recorded from a hurricane. We had an EF3 back from a 2004 hurricane, Hurricane Francis. That tornado hit South Carolina, causing damage. So a very rare tornado outbreak witnessed in Florida from Milton.
What have I missed, Jeff? Is there something else that catches your attention about these storms or this hurricane season?
We've seen three of the top eight water levels on record just this year at two of our major stations that have tide gauges in Florida, both at Naples and at Fort Myers. We had Hurricane Debby, Hurricane Helene, and now Hurricane Milton all set top eight water level records at these stations. So that speaks both to how unusual it is for the west coast of Florida to get storms like this, and also to the fact that sea level rise is making it easier to set these sorts of records. Also, Milton was the fifth strongest Atlantic hurricane ever recorded, 180 mile per hour winds, central pressure 897 millibars. That's the kind of thing we expect to see with climate change. With a warmer ocean, in fact, a record warm ocean like we had this year, that helped very directly to support Hurricane Milton's incredible intensity and that of Hurricane Helene just 2 weeks prior, Cat 4 storm. Record warm waters mean more Cat 4 and Cat 5 hurricanes.
From Yale Climate Connections, we have been speaking with meteorologist and confessed storm chaser Dr. Jeff Masters. Get his excellent updates at Yale Climate Connections. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you for stopping by when the world's going kind of crazy about hurricanes and typhoons.
Sure, Alex. Always happy to chat.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Even longtime weather reporters were shocked by the 1-2 punch of hurricanes Helene and Milton. Dr. Michael Wehner is not. Michael is a senior scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He testifies to Congress and appears in major media, as well as on Radio EcoShock last February. Dr. Wehner has published extensively on hurricanes. From California, Michael Wehner, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me back.
An Atlantic magazine headline reads, "Milton is the hurricane that scientists were dreading." You say the rapid development of Milton is shocking, but not surprising. How come?
Well, we've long known that rapid intensification of hurricanes and tropical cyclones can happen when the water is underneath is warm because it can provide so much energy, and that because of climate change, because of global warming, this circumstance is it's happening more frequently where the water is warm enough to enable rapid intensification. So this is something that has long been expected. I mean, I don't think this is the first one of these that has been made more intense by climate change, and it certainly won't be the last. So it's shocking, don't get me wrong, but it's not surprising.
It is still early as we speak with a lot of unknowns, but what seemed remarkable to you about Hurricane Milton as it spun up in the Gulf of Mexico? Anything?
Well, its rapid intensification was particularly large. The formal definition is 35 miles an hour increase in wind speeds in 24 hours, and it far exceeded that. And so that kind of, you know, explosive growth in intensity and the energy of a storm is pretty remarkable.
With two colleagues at Lawrence Berkeley Lab, you issued a provisional attribution statement about extremely intense rainfall during 24 hours of Hurricane Helene. You said, quote, "Our best estimate is that climate change may have caused as much as 50% more rainfall during Hurricane Helene in some parts of Georgia and the Carolinas," end quote. Why were rains so extreme that Asheville and many other small communities were partly washed away?
Well, what we've known from this study and quite a number of other formal peer-reviewed studies of other hurricanes is that climate change makes the rainfall more intense. It really kind of supercharges the rainfall in these very large storms. And that's because of two things. One is that it's well publicized, I think, that the warmer air can hold more water. And so when the air is fully saturated, like in a hurricane, there's 7% more water contained in that atmosphere, in that air, per degree centigrade of warming. But that's not the end of the story. The other part of the story is that because it's warmer, there's also more energy. Because there's more energy, the winds are a little bit stronger, you know, 5 or 8% maybe. And that causes the vertical motion of the storm to be considerably stronger, making the storm more efficient. And so you sort of have a double whammy. You've got more moisture because of the ability of the atmosphere, to, warmer atmosphere, to hold more moisture. And then the storm is more efficient at raining out that increased available moisture.
And on the subject of extreme rains, you co-authored a paper in 2022 finding that both extreme three-hourly rainfall rates and extreme three-day accumulated rainfall amounts are increasing. What does that mean, and why does it matter?
Well, it means that severe storms are more severe, and that floods are bigger, and that the impacts, the suffering of the people that live in those regions is made worse.
Rubble from Hurricane Helene was still lining streets in coastal Florida as Milton barreled towards them. Research published February 2023 in Nature Climate Change was titled Increasing Sequential Tropical Cyclone Hazards Along the U.S. East and Gulf Coasts. So it sounds like scientists were already aware and looking at multiple impact events like the ones we've just seen.
Well, having sequential storms is something that has happened in the past and will continue in the future. I think what's different is that because the frequency of major hurricanes, you know, category 3, 4, 5, is increased, the odds of having two rather serious ones in a row is increased.
But you are co-author of a June 2022 paper in the same journal titled Declining Tropical Cyclone Frequency Under Global Warming. So are we expecting fewer hurricanes, but larger when they come?
Well, you've just highlighted probably the most interesting question in hurricane climate science, climate change science today. And that is, what's going to happen to the frequency of tropical storms across the planet of all strengths, from tropical storm strength to Category 5? And there's differences of opinions. In our paper and in some of our other work, we've shown that the total number of storms will decrease with a warmer world, and that's because the atmosphere is somewhat more stable in a warmer world. But there, another point of view, Kerry Emanuel being one of the proponents, is that's not the case, that the number of hurricanes across the world will stay more or less the same. I think we all agree that the distribution of hurricane winds is shifting towards larger values. So whether or not there's more or less is sort of one interesting question. But given that the big storms are the ones that cause the most suffering and damages, those are going to be bigger and more frequent. I think we're pretty much on the same page, regardless of what we think about this other question of frequency. I guess I would also say that, you know, I don't think we know the answer to this, but it could be different in different basins, that, you know, what controls the frequency of hurricanes in the Atlantic could be very different than what controls in the Western Pacific, for instance.
Yes, I kind of presume that the theory would be that the atmosphere would become more stable as the planet warms. And by the way, listeners, that's not a good thing, because we need the winds and the ocean currents to keep flowing as they do now. But, Michael, how far off would that stabilization be in theory, and could we encounter more violent disruptions in the transition?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think I know the answer to that. But I do know that, you know, storms like Milton are not as unusual as they once were. Milton is currently the strongest tropical cyclone that's happened this year, but it won't be the strongest in the decade, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it's rated now as either the fourth or the fifth strongest Atlantic hurricane that we've recorded so far. But yes, there have been some giants, Wilma and Rita and Harvey, and on we go. I wanted to ask, have these twin disasters of the 2024 hurricane season, which is far from over, have they left a story for scientists and like yourself to study, or do we already know enough?
Well, there are interesting questions about the impacts of these storms that still remain. For Hurricane Helene, this storm is a little different than the ones we've made attribution statements in the past, the important ones being most recently Hurricane Ian and Hurricane Florence, and before that Hurricane Harvey. And there, when we were talking about the rainfall, it was all in relatively flat areas, Florida and coastal Carolina and Texas. Houston, Texas. And this storm, of course, was in the mountains, the Smoky Mountains. And topography is an important factor in the pattern of rainfall and the amount of rainfall. And so I think an interesting question for me is, you know, how does the presence of steep topography interact with these known effects of climate change on rainfall? You know, does it make it worse, or does it have no effect, or less? I mean, we don't know the answer to that yet.
Yes. When we talked in February, you called for a new Cat 6 designation to cover more powerful storms as climate changes. Has there been any progress on that?
Well, I think to be clear, we're not advocating for an official expansion of the Saffir-Simpson scale. In fact, you know, our view on this now is that the Saffir-Simpson scale is useful for pointing out that the risk of major hurricanes has increased. There are, you know, more Cat 5 storms than there used to be, and, you know, these Cat 6 storms would be, you know, a new phenomenon. But what we really feel is that as a warning tool for warning the public of the dangers of an impending storm, like currently with Milton, the Saffir-Simpson scale isn't very good. A single number can't convey the kind of risk that people, the information about risk that people need to know to take action. And so instead, what we're encouraging is that people utilize the verbal warnings and the graphical products of the National Hurricane Center, whether they obtain them directly from their website or from their local broadcast meteorologist, because these tell you exactly what you need to know. You know, are you in a flood zone? You know, are the winds going to be, you know, very, very damaging in your particular neighborhood or region? And, you know, and whether to take action or not. And so we urge people to, you know, in a case like this with an impending storm, to pay no attention to the category and pay more attention to these detailed products so they know how to stay safe.
Yes, one of those new detailed products that I just saw on a local station in Florida is that they can project, I don't know if they're doing it by satellite or by radar, where the debris fields are, so that if stuff from the previous hurricane gets lifted up into the air and thrown around, they can actually map out where it's going. Fantastic stuff.
Yeah, indeed. Radar can show when this is moving, and that's one of the ways that tornadoes can be visualized in real time by the debris that it kicks up. And in fact, Milton has produced quite a large number of tornadoes, and so that's yet another hazard from tropical cyclones that is still, you know, not as well understood as it needs to be.
And at least one of those cyclones generated by Milton was an EF3, which one weather person said they couldn't find any record of that in that part of Florida before.
That's astonishing.
Yep. So as we wrap up here on a personal level, and maybe not speaking for the lab, Michael, you saw this coming many years ago. How does it feel to now live out this awful confirmation of those predictions you and your team made? How do you handle that?
Well, it's awful, of course. I mean, you know, we've known this was coming, you know, that this kind of extreme weather was, you know, dangerous climate change being manifested through this kind of extreme weather. And the human tragedy is moving for anyone, especially, you know, for these last two storms, because I've had friends who are impacted. And, you know, that moves this out of the academic regime for someone like me and becomes much more personal.
From Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, we've been speaking with senior scientist Michael Wehner, and you can find links to all the science and news we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you for sharing time with us as the storms roll in.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If there is a hurricane man in science, that may be Dr. Kerry Emanuel. For decades, Dr. Emanuel published highly cited benchmark papers on tropical cyclones, as they are known in the field. His book, Divine Wind, The History and Science of Hurricanes, is right here on my shelf. Dr. Emanuel is now Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric Sciences at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. From Massachusetts, Kerry Emanuel, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Thank you for joining us. Our time is short, so I'd like to begin with your general impressions of Hurricanes Helene and Milton, and then go to broader debates in big storm science. So, almost out of nowhere, two big storms just smashed into Florida in less than 2 weeks. What does that tell us, Kerry, and are experts seeing anything new in this storm behavior?
Well, we learn something from every single hurricane that happens, particularly the ones that are dangerous and cause so much suffering. And Helene and Milton really together have caused a terrific amount of suffering, loss of life, loss of property, etc. And from a meteorologist's standpoint, there were some unusual aspects to both of these storms. Helene set many records, particularly in the Appalachians, for rainfall. And what I like to remind viewers of is that it is usually water from rains, also storm surges, that kills the most people and does the most damage, and yet we keep talking about them as windstorms. Helene caused most of its damage through flooding, and a great deal of damage that was. With Milton, there were some interesting aspects that were somewhat surprising. It intensified very rapidly, have near record intensification rates, and we've been saying for years that those intensification rates would go up quickly as we warm the planet. It reached an intensity which puts it up in the top five, certainly, of Atlantic hurricanes in terms of wind speed and low pressure. Fortunately, it lost some strength, as it was forecast to do, before making landfall. Unfortunately, it made landfall south of Tampa. Otherwise, there would have been a lot more damage and flooding in a major metropolitan city in Florida. Another meteorologically interesting thing is that while most hurricane landfalls produce a few usually weak tornadoes, Milton produced a lot of tornadoes, some of which were very strong, and we're going to have to study this to find out what exactly happened.
What is your criticism of the current Cat 1 to Cat 5 hurricane system used almost everywhere by media and government?
Because it's focused not only on a storm, but on the wrong aspect of the storm. I mean, yes, wind is very dangerous and it kills people, but it is not the most dangerous aspect of the storm, and the Saffir-Simpson scale simply doesn't address that. I've been a strong advocate of moving away from a storm-based forecast and warning system to a people-based warning system. We should focus on the threats to people and not on where's the storm and where's it going. That turns out to mislead a lot of people. They think they're not near the center of the storm. They're going to be fine. That didn't do a lot of good for the people in southeastern Florida this time, for example. But it doesn't address the water. So I go to a system in which we have, instead of maps of the storm, we have maps of the expected threat. Here's where we expect there to be lots of flooding. Here we expect there may be tornadoes. There we expect that there may be strong winds. These can be overlapping, maybe just simple colors, green for perfectly safe to red, you better get out. But with concise statements that describe to people the nature of the threat. And stop talking about where's the storm. That's what our job is as meteorologists. But to communicate that, we've got to focus on people.
People are understandably nervous about hurricanes or typhoons. They are just awesome things. You worked on the upper limits to hurricanes for decades. Could novel storms develop bigger than anything recorded so far?
Oh, yes, they should be able to do that. We're lifting the cap on how strong hurricanes can be. And if you look at the hurricanes in the record books today, most of them have occurred since 2000. and some of them more recently than that. So we are beginning to see this, maybe not so far in a statistically completely satisfying way, but I would put my money on us breaking records for storm intensity going into the future.
I talked with Michael Weiner for the show, and he wondered whether superstorms above Cat 5 wind speeds would be able to maintain themselves. They may choke off their own energy, as Hurricane Milton did when forming a new eyewall. I notice you just co-authored a new paper on eyewalls this year. Your thoughts on the limits to storm organization?
What we see is when we look at the distribution, the statistical distribution of storm intensity, say, as measured by their lifetime peak winds for each storm, what was the strongest wind recorded while it was alive? We look at those statistics and we normalize them by this theoretical upper bound, we get the same distribution everywhere. And so I think it's a pretty strong hypothesis to say that that distribution won't change. And if that's true, the rising cap of the storm intensity will lift all boats. Even the very weak hurricanes will be a little bit stronger. Whether the whole frequency of storms goes up or down is not known to science at this point. But it's a sure bet that I don't think there's any physics that will stop us seeing storms that beat the current record intensity.
I have been telling listeners we still do not know why hurricanes actually spin up. Even when seas are record hot and conditions are ripe, hurricanes may not appear, as happened in August this year for a while. You've been working on this for years again. Do you know why hurricanes form?
Well, not as well as we would like, to be honest. What we do know for sure is that you have to have a very humid atmosphere, not just near the sea surface, where it's always humid in the tropics, but all the way up to 10 or 12 miles. You have to have a humid column. And if you don't have that, if you can't create that, then hurricanes can't form. And we actually think we understand that part of it pretty well. What we understand less well is how you create such columns and how that might vary with the climate state. So I haven't looked at this, have time to look at this very closely, but we have this lull in what should have been the peak of the hurricane season this year, for example, in the early part of September, where we should have had a lot and we didn't have anything. And my suspicion is that the atmosphere, for whatever reason, was particularly dry then. Now, I don't know that. I could be proved wrong. Even if that turns out to be the case, we have to understand why it suddenly dried out. What was it responding to? So we have a ways to go, but I think science is making progress toward this, and we're increasingly able to even predict with models, at least, where storms might form in the next couple of days.
In 2020, you co-authored an expert reassessment of projected hurricane response to anthropogenic warming. What is generally expected of storms in a human-induced 2-degree hotter world, and what is still in debate or unknown?
Okay, so going from the most confident to the least confident, we're all confident that a given hurricane, given that you're having a hurricane, will produce a lot more rain. The physics behind that is really, really simple. Basically, when it's hotter, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor, and therefore there's more water vapor to precipitate. It's not much more complicated than that. We think that it might even be a little bit worse than that because the storms are also stronger, and all of things being equal, a stronger storm will produce more rain. The next thing we're most confident of is what we have just been talking about, that the intensity of hurricanes should increase. We're certainly beginning to see that in satellite-based observations of storm intensity. Where we have very little confidence is whether the total number of storms, like in the Atlantic basin or anywhere else, or the total number of storms around the world, whether that will go up or down or stay the same. We just don't know. There are factors pulling storms in opposite directions that way. We kind of know what those factors are, but we don't know how they balance. We don't know which ones will win yet, so we still have to work on that.
We study the effect of climate on tropical cyclones. What about the reverse, the impact of giant storms on natural systems and warming? Could there be a feedback?
Yeah, this is a fascinating question. Certainly it's fascinated me and some of my colleagues for years. Are these just, you know, flukes that really don't matter to the climate system? Or are they an integral part of the climate system and there is a feedback? There are two plausible ways that hurricanes can feed back on the climate. First of all, they're great big dryers of the atmosphere. By precipitating so much water out, well, most of that water comes from the atmosphere, hurricanes dry out the atmosphere. And that's really demonstrably the case. And that changes things. When you have a drier atmosphere, basically you're taking a greenhouse gas, water vapor, out. So you're opening up a window for heat to escape from the surface of the Earth into space. So from that point of view, they could be a cooling effect on the climate and try to sort of damp down changes in the climate, such as the changes we're bringing about by putting greenhouse gases in. That happens is almost undoubtedly the case. Whether it's important enough to be noticeable or to have a really big effect, that we don't really understand yet. The other way they could potentially modify the system is through the ocean in several ways, both biogeochemically and physically. Physically, they churn cold water to the surface, and that's sort of a cooling effect in the tropics. But they leave behind these cold water wakes, and those gradually recover, but they recover by robbing, well, the atmosphere of heat that it would otherwise receive. You're taking heat out of the atmosphere and putting it in the ocean, and the ocean has to do something with it. And it does something by creating ocean currents that transport that heat to other places. That turns out to be not such a small effect, and it might serve to change, not so much to mitigate climate change as to affect its regionality, where it will warm more and where it will warm less, for example. So those are the two big ones. And I should mention on the ocean side, too, there's the biogeochemistry. When it turns up all the cold water, that cold water is rich in nutrients, and you're suddenly exposing it to sunlight, and there are these big phytoplankton blooms, which you can see from satellite, and they change the biology of the ocean in ways that I think we're only beginning to understand.
There's a media storm about Milton because it struck the United States, really, and one of your early fact sheets said less than 15% of tropical cyclones rise in the Atlantic. The Pacific is much busier, and unknown to many people, massive storms brought death and wreckage to the Philippines and China in recent years. Can you tell us about one or two of those monsters in the Pacific?
Well, yes, there's the Pacific, and I would add the Indian Ocean and the Southern Hemisphere to that, but for example, Typhoon Haiyan, which struck the Philippines not much more than 10 years ago, was a horrific event. It was probably the most intense typhoon we've seen in the record books in that part of the world. Even though the Philippines experiences Cat 5 typhoons very frequently and is quite well prepared, nobody could have been prepared for that storm. It was really horrific, the amount of damage it did. And as you suggested, we don't, in the United States, pay as much attention to overseas disasters as our own, which is natural, but we have to remember that they still occur.
What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm working on how we can use our increasing understanding of the physics of hurricanes to lessen the risk that they pose to society. We're trying to help insurance companies, reinsurance companies, cities and towns deal with the risk. Well, I mean, most importantly, to mitigate it, but our particular angles, how do you actually avoid some of the risk? For example, by changing policies in such a way as to encourage people to migrate from risky to safer places, where in fact what's happening is exactly the opposite. And this is all policy-driven. We're inadvertently subsidizing people to move to risky places for hurricanes and other risks when we should be subsidizing them to move the other direction. So I'm trying to change that at the moment. It's a big, big thing to chew on, but there you go.
A quick question as we wrap up. We're obviously in a dire climate emergency. Have you considered wrapping up your research to focus even more on climate education and activism?
Well, research is what sort of keeps me going personally. Without doing it, it's very important to me on a personal level. But I am trying to devote more attention to education and to these programs to help society deal with hurricane risks in a more effective way.
We've been speaking with one of the world's great hurricane experts, Kerry Emanuel. He is Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric Science at MIT. You can find links to the science we just discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you for helping our listeners.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
An insurance company expert ballparked property losses in Florida to reach $250 billion after Hurricanes Helene and Milton. Only about $5 billion of that is covered by private companies. The majority of Florida property owners are not covered by any flood insurance at all. People already living close to the line, including working families and millions of seniors, will be wiped out. Those without relatives or resources may become homeless unless some kind of temporary camps emerge from the government. That kind of happened with the FEMA trailers after Hurricane Katrina. Others, though, will leave the state and start over somewhere else. They are climb migrants, as Patrick Marchman calls them. Marchman has a master's degree in marine affairs from the University of Washington. He is a certified environmental planner. Patrick is a member of the Agenda Setters for the Climate Migration Network. Patrick Marchman, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
It was frightening to see piles of debris roadside from Hurricane Helene, and less than 2 weeks later, a lot of that became airborne projectiles and Milton's winds. It is a bit hard to comprehend what just happened. How do you make sense of these compound climate threats?
That's a good question. I think you used the right phrase, compound climate threats. These are just sort of the 1-2 punches. You're having events happen pretty quickly, one after the other, and it's almost as if you don't really have time or to repair or to recuperate or to do much else except to hunker down. And unfortunately, this is the kind of thing that's to be expected to increase.
And they had a similar thing, I think, in Houston. They had a big hurricane, floods all over the place, kind of a mess, and then a heat wave. And, of course, the power was out for thousands, hundreds of thousands of people and no AC. So these things can combine like that. Are you ready, Patrick, to make any predictions on what will unfold for Florida communities that were hit by Hurricane Helene and Milton? Will they try to rebuild with just the same and no adaptation?
It's very early. It's hard to always tell, but I think generally, unfortunately, yes. So there's going to be largely an attempt to rebuild to whatever was there before. I think there'll be attempts here and there to adapt. There'll be some good ones, but I think in general, people are just going to try to get back to where they are, and unfortunately, they're going to be supported in that by a lot of policy and the infrastructure.
Well, as an environmental planner, what's the alternative?
There's a couple of angles. Number one, it's really to start thinking seriously about how people live on the landscape. And that's going to mean, in some places, low-lying areas. Elevating homes is going to mean burying infrastructure, and it's going to mean some people really should, probably not be there long-term. I think, in other ways, it'll mean lots of trying to work on hardening the power systems. You mentioned before sort of power outages. That's a real concern, especially as temperatures increase. People die from that. And so having microgrids and such that make overall power systems harder to knock out would be a very good thing to do. And the final thing, I think, really encouraging people to know each other and to check on each other. The most basic form of resilience, probably the most effective form, is community. And so, of course, in the Western world, we're having a problem with that in most places these days. But people knowing their neighbors, checking on them, having places they can go, there's really no real substitute for that. Something I would recommend very highly.
Yes, that's a great point, because we so often think of technical solutions. All right, we'll make houses on stilts that float up and down as they did in the Netherlands or something. But really, it is the human community that we need to work on. And right now in the United States and in other countries, it's kind of divided, and people haven't been talking to each other and don't even like each other if they're in the other party. So we've got to overcome that if we're going to deal with climate change, I think. And there's another aspect here for business. I mean, hurricanes cost a lot more than property damage. Among the hidden costs I noted, Port Tampa Bay, a major shipping hub, closed for days during these storms. The big cruise lines canceled out. The tourists fled. Disney World shut all their operations. Goldman Sachs calculated Hurricane Milton will cost Disney somewhere between $100 and $200 million in earnings. So climate change is costing big business big money. Are you seeing the signs that corporations are becoming more aware of the risk and maybe trying to get ready?
That's complicated. There are signs that they're becoming more aware, especially in the past couple of years. I've been personally heartened by seeing companies looking into climate adaptation as a specific thing. It's new. There's a lot of people, a lot of times they don't really know how to articulate it, but it's there. However, it's still really sort of the minority opinion. The general short-termism of sort of late capitalism has an incentive structure to, you know, try to make your money, get the money and run. You see that a lot of times in places like, frankly, Miami. You know, people know, at this point, we all kind of know the future, and yet there's a bit of a game of musical chairs in terms of, you know, the real estate industry and such. The other thing I think, you know, I wanted to kind of bring up when we're talking about business is there's a concept which I've been really interested in the past few years called sort of, and I call it sort of manager treat death spiral. It's a little dramatic, but basically it's the idea that it's not just moving people around, and we're talking about moving people here and there, but it has real impacts on the structure of municipal finance and such. And so when there's simply, you know, when more damage and fewer people to pay for it, that gets harder to repair the damage earlier, and you get into a spiral of these sort of things. And so insurance, the insurance industry is a massive player in this as well. But we're talking just in general resources. And so a business has a big part in that too. Eventually business decides to stop throwing good money after bad, and they will start pulling out to places where the money is safer.
Well, you've managed big budget government programs, and you sometimes advise private companies. What is it that you're doing? What is your role here?
My role is, so I've been doing a lot of things recently. You know, I've, as you mentioned earlier, I was part of the Climate Action Network leadership for a long time. You know, I've done a lot of things, I've spoken in places. I've been very gratified to have that opportunity. What I'm doing a lot right now is I'm working a lot with small, mid-sized cities and tribes and communities, both in, you know, California and throughout the Midwest and places, really working with them on a really direct level, working on different, you know, plans, climate adaptation, hazard mitigation plans and such. It's really interesting to zero down and talk to these organizations, talk to these jurisdictions, seeing what people are concerned about. Because I think that's, I've also worked with a few companies directly that, you know, one I can think of was a largely remote-first company, and they had a whole different set of problems, which is how do you run a remote-first company in an age of, say, you know, climate shocks? Because we talk about the internet, for instance, the internet is actually physically based. It's physical wires, physical servers. We don't think about that a lot, but when they go down, there is no internet. And so what do you do about that? So I think, you know, amount of conversations I've had, it comes as a shock sometimes, but it's good if people, you know, when you get some of the politics out of it, you know, just keep it down to like, okay, here's the realities, what kind of impacts are coming, and what can we do about it? There, people are receptive more often than you think.
You know, I think your field is going to really blossom in the next few years, certainly the next decade, because we see that companies can be very mobile if it saves them money. I mean, headquarters and factories do move from one state to another. Boeing did it. Do you foresee company migration, say, out of Florida or Houston to higher ground further inland?
Absolutely. It just depends on when that's going to happen. I would say one example, I think there's actually been studies now, which is one of the interesting things in the past 5 years, you're starting to see studies and indications that, you know, things are happening. It's not speculation. There was one, I forget the name of it, mentioning, I think, in the state of Nevada in the U.S., that that heat is actually becoming a consideration in terms of, you know, whether companies are going to move there or not. And again, it's only one consideration. It's not the dominant one yet, but it's starting to be factored in. So
You're going to see that with some calculations when it comes to sea level rise or storm exposure. Yeah, definitely. I expect that to happen. I also know that there are cities in the northern parts of the U.S. in the Rust Belt that are thinking about this very hard in terms of using their location as a way to potentially attract some of the industry that they lost over the past few decades.
You know, I used to be more of a doomer. I thought that the system might crash at any time. But now it seems like this is a very diverse and capable system of just sort of rerouting things and rebuilding and keeping itself going, even maybe in directions where it shouldn't as far as the climate goes. But I don't know if it's too far out to picture a climate migrant camps. That is surely coming for Bangladesh. It's a reality for millions of refugees in the Sahel part of North Africa, I think. But in the U.S., U.K., or Canada, is it just that these climate retreat camps seem super unlikely, or is it just hard to imagine now? We just had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in temporary shelters in Florida, and some of their homes are demolished, so they're not going back. I don't know what happens to people after these big events.
I don't think it's unrealistic. I think, you know, it's really just a really question of time. And I think, as you noted quite rightly, it has happened in different degrees. And you can also look at, it'll happen in different populations sooner rather than later. But I absolutely do think so. I'm not what you call a doomer right now. I think the system is resilient, but I think things break down and such. And I think we're at the very early stages. We're at really the beginning of things. So the past 5 years, we've started to see events where what ordinary people look at and say, boy, that's unusual. And we're at the very start. So I personally, if I have to bet on this, I think we're probably in decades to come, and maybe sooner than some people think. It's a vision. I have this almost vision in my head about former McMansion residents, upper middle class people, you know, ending up in, you know, camps and soup lines in a camp in, say, Manitoba or Maine someday, and being really confused about what happened even then. I think it's been very easy to kind of dismiss this when it's just somebody in Bangladesh or a native village in Alaska, and it's a curiosity and such. And then later on, we see, you know, high school starting to close in, you know, rural Louisiana parishes, simply because people are moving in an unmanaged way. And again, we sort of classify that as, oh, that's something to think about. But I think, you know, when it does hit, and I do think there will be places that, again, the good upper middle class people, the secure people who've done everything right in the system, I think they're going to get impacted. And I think it's going to come as a real shock. And there'll be repercussions in political ways as well. And I can't predict what they are, but I do think it's coming. I just don't know when.
Patrick Marchman has a degree from the University of Michigan. You can find his network at www.climigration.org or find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for sharing with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Next week, we focus on the nasty after effects of Hurricane Helene in the Appalachian Mountains with author Mike Tidwell. His book is The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. I also hope to speak with the granddaddy of coastal erosion and climate change in the U.S. Southeast, Dr. Oren Pilkey. His new book is Escaping Nature, How to Survive Climate Change. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this shocking, wonderful world.